Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 70, High on the Hog. Sunday, February 22nd, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yinhu Chaiyuan, Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode can be found on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode includes the following segments: ever-expanding skill set, sheep to shawl, the front porch, off the shelf, and yarn lover at large. Since I've recorded last, there have been several listeners who have introduced themselves on the Ravelry, Threads, or in a personal message. So I'd like to extend a very special welcome to Lisa, who is Fiber Nymph and host of the 90% Knitting podcast, Astrid, who is Strid8 on Ravelry, or maybe Stride8. Astrid is from Gloucester, Mass. Welcome. Jeanette, who is Bookish Stitcher and host of a video cast by the same name. Lori, who is Knits with Bears. Patty B, who's Pat in Vermont. And Oak Blossoms, who is Heather Lee in Montana. There has also been a new iTunes review posted. Thank you, Lori Langley, for that very complimentary review. This afternoon, I am recording from downstairs at Yin Hu in front of our beautiful fireplace. We do not heat our home with a fireplace, but when it becomes very cold and we have a weekend where we don't have a lot of things to do outside of the house, I like to keep a fire going. It does kick out a little bit of heat, and that's especially important while I'm recording because I don't like the sound of the heating system operating while I'm recording a podcast. So I'm curled up in front of the fireplace and I can look outside in the late afternoon light. It snowed yesterday, but that's all done, and we were up above freezing temperatures today. And there is a lot of activity on the suet feeders hanging from the eaves. We have a wraparound porch on the first floor, and there's an eave that extends way out beyond the porch railing. And it's a great place for us to hang our bird feeders. We like to use black oiled sunflower seeds, and I love to put a suet in our suet feeders because we have several varieties of woodpeckers who come to the feeders. And other tree clinging birds use the suet feeder as well. And there has been a lot of activity just now as I got my equipment together with a very large, hairy woodpecker feeding at the suet feeder. I've noticed that all woodpecker varieties announce their approach to the feeder with a series of loud chirps. They're very abrasive and very staccato chirps. I guess it's an aggressive kind of thing to sort of make a claim on the feeder. And it's very rare for more than one bird to be feeding at the suet feeder at one time. The hairy woodpecker is so large that it has a hard time feeding at the feeder. It uses its tail to get leverage against a tree trunk, but the suet feeder is just a small wire square and it doesn't really have anywhere to press its tail up against, so it's constantly swinging back and forth on the feeder. I think that agitates it a little bit, and it seems to be chirping the whole time it's on the feeder. Last weekend, I participated in the Great Backyard Bird Count. It was suggested by Paula of the Knitting Pipeline podcast, and I've never done anything like that before. So for several days, I sat for 10 to 15 minutes watching birds at our feeders and entering data online. It was all pretty easy to do as far as entering the data, but it was sometimes difficult to estimate how many birds of a particular kind were feeding at once, because quite a few of the bird species, like the black-capped chickadee and also the tufted titmouse, they come to the feeder, take a seed, and then fly away. So it can be difficult to know exactly how many of them there are doing that at one given time. There are a few species, however, that have been really aggressive at our feeder. They're not here the whole season. They seem to come late in the season. But in particular, there are pine siskins who perch on our tube feeders and just kind of hang out there. And they don't let any of the other birds come to take food. And they empty the feeders very rapidly. I've been watching them carefully. They're right outside my window, but then even watching more carefully with a pair of binoculars. And it doesn't really even look like they're eating the sunflower seeds. It looks like they're just reaching in to get one and then throwing it out on the ground. Very irritating. And the other less aggressive birds, like the chickadees and the titmouse, they don't come to the feeder while those pine siskins are there. So I don't know what we're going to do about that. I think Samuel read into mounting the bird feeders upside down because many kinds of birds will perch and then retrieve a seed from underneath the perch, but the pine siskins will not do that. I don't know how easy that would be. But oh, I wanted to talk about the several different kinds of woodpeckers that we have here at our location in the Poconos. And there are four that I've noticed. We have pileated woodpeckers. They do not come to the suet feeder. And we see them more frequently in the warmer weather than we do in the colder weather. Although, when I'm shoveling outside, I will often hear one hammering on some, you know, dead tree limb or something like that. In the summer, we see them quite frequently, and they will, if it's a quiet day with not a lot of traffic, they will hang out in trees that are close to the house. But in winter, we have three main kinds. Two come to the suet feeders quite often, the hairy woodpecker that I mentioned and the downy. They look very similar, except for the hairy woodpecker is much larger. The downy is smaller and, as the name suggests, a little fluffier in appearance. They both have predominantly black and white feathering in a very similar pattern, and they will have red patches. The males have red patches at the napes of their necks. This year, for the first time, there have been quite a few sightings of the red-bellied woodpecker, and this woodpecker has even started coming to the suet feeder over the course of the past month or so. This is a beautiful bird. It has black and white feathering on its back in a much finer, more delicate kind of stripy pattern than the hairy or the downy woodpecker. As the name suggests, there is a blush color on the belly of this woodpecker, and then its entire head is a beautiful orange red. So it's very easy to spot on trees in the wintertime because it's easy to see when it's flying or moving around. It's a lot of fun to watch through binoculars when it's climbing up and down on tree limbs. And as I said, it has made frequent visits here to the feeders. Ever-expanding skill set. This month for the Power Pantry cook-along, Yarns at Yinhu listeners have been playing the pantry game, and they have been doing it exceedingly well. It's so gratifying to know how many kindred spirits there are out there, and it seems like a lot of folks have enjoyed the challenge of avoiding a trip to the grocery store, especially the kind that usually precede bad weather forecasts, and just cooking from ingredients on hand at home. And I've seen posts with some very creative and delicious ideas, proving that you don't need to make recipes with lists of specialty ingredients to have a great meal. You can use what's on hand, feel great about it, save money, and still have something hearty and delicious. I've been wanting to try a version of a recipe that was posted by Sen One online, and then Swensty posted a similar, or what I interpreted as a similar kind of recipe. And I thought that it would be a good exercise to pull out some ingredients that I had on hand and try my own version or a blend of these two recipes. It all started when I said something about really enjoying a soup with a lot of ginger in it. I got a suggestion for a yellow pea soup. It's kind of like split pea, but you use yellow peas instead of the normal green. There's a lot of ginger in this recipe, and I found a variety of it online. It's a Deborah Madison recipe, and she's the author of the vegetable literacy cookbook that I mentioned, I don't know, several months ago that I took out from our school library. But I didn't have all of the ingredients for that on hand. And then Swensty, Sarah Hunt of the FiberTrek podcast, mentioned another recipe that had cauliflower in it. So I had this idea of using roasted cauliflower as a substitute for rice. For a long time, I have been roasting cauliflower florets until they have the rusty spots on them and they get kind of crunchy, and I like them with a little bit of salt. And I use them in a variety of different ways, or sometimes just to eat as a side dish. But I thought, what would happen if I made this really creamy soup with a lot of ginger and coconut milk and these yellow peas? And then I ladled that over cauliflower instead of over rice. It worked really well. I liked it a lot. I found a few odd ingredients and used them up in the recipe. One was half a jar of roasted red peppers that I diced very finely. Another was, oh, from a recipe I had developed several months ago, I had kale pesto. And there was really too much to use in the dish that I was making, at least to my taste. So I put some of it in a small container in the freezer. And the recipe Sarah suggested had spinach leaves in the soup. So I thought, well, I could just add this kale pesto in place of the spinach. It was good. But what happened was it turned the entire soup green, the exact color of split pea soup. And then the third ingredient I found was a partially used container of Greek yogurt. Someone else had mentioned on the board that Greek yogurt is just a fantastic thing to have on hand. And I used a dollop of yogurt to garnish the soup and also a squeeze of lemon juice. One of the recipes called for lime juice. Overall, I think it was a successful round of playing the pantry game. I did write up the recipe and posted it as a blog post with a photo on the yarnsatyinhu.com blog. So you can check it out there. Of course, you will not have the same odd assortment of things on hand, but hopefully there's enough of a structure there to give you an idea of what you might do with some of your pantry ingredients. And I'd love to know if you try it out. We have another week of playing the pantry game, and then in March, we're going to focus our attention on tools in the kitchen. It's my guess that having a solid array of cooking tools, including handheld things as well as maybe even expensive appliances, helps you to use the ingredients you have on hand. And I'm curious about what kinds of appliances and tools you find really handy. If you have go-to recipes that require you to use certain tools, I'd also like to know about buyer's remorse and any tools or appliances you have consciously decided to live without, especially if you have a small kitchen like I do. I'm always interested in knowing what shortcuts people take and what they are not willing to give up. So in March, we'll have tools as the focus of our hashtag Power Pantry discussion. Keep up the posts, the photos, the links. It's been a lot of fun and very rewarding. Sheep to Shawl. The second session of the Sheep to Shawl class at the Fibercraft Studio in Chestnut Ridge, New York, took place on Valentine's Day. Again, the weather presented a little bit of a challenge, but not too much. And there was a spell of about 30 to 45 minutes in the afternoon where snow was falling outside, and we quieted down a little bit because we have a great tendency towards chattiness in the class. And everyone was working on spinning and carding and looking out the window. Oh, it was just so peaceful and restorative. I have a plan, a commitment to use the Sheep to Shawl sessions as no tech days, where I refrain from going online and social media and things like that. And that is a great plan. But it means that I missed out on sending the amazing vintage Valentines that you can send on Ravelry. So I feel badly about that. Very grateful for all of the Valentines I received. Thank you so much for thinking of me and sending charming little notes. And I'll be back in the game next year with sending some very sweet Valentines. It's such a great tradition that they do that. It's really a lot of fun. This second session of Sheep to Shawl was devoted to methods of hand carding and hand processing our washed wool. I got a lot more experience and had several questions about hand carding answered. And then, of course, I just couldn't stop working on the fiber that I brought home following the session. And we had a long weekend from school, so I had a lot of time to devote to working on washing and carding, and then a couple different techniques for spinning the fiber that I brought home. I tried putting some of this carded fiber on my spinning wheel, as well as using the spindle. And I've kept the colors somewhat separate, so I'm still aiming for a white or a slightly off-white, and then a few different tones of gray, and then a very, very deep brown. So as of this morning, all of the wool that I brought home has been washed, carded, spun up, skeined up, and washed. Ah, and now I'm searching through my fiber stash for more things to spin and work on, which I'll talk about a little bit in the next segment. I also started to knit with a little bit of my hand-spun yarn. Our first assignment is to make a small bag or pouch, and I used three different colors, natural colors, to knit a small amulet with some beads, and I used a button from my grandmother's button box as a closing fastener. And it's not perfect, but it came out pretty well. And I think I might write my pattern and make some adjustments and try another version of that before the next session. I've also started thinking about a shawl or garment with additional yarn that I've spun. And I think I need to get a lot more consistent if that's going to happen, because so far I've been processing small bits of fiber and then spinning each one in a different way. And I'm not sure how easy it would be to bring all of that together as a garment. So maybe I need to focus on a little more consistency in the future. The front porch. As I mentioned, all of this spinning got me in a mood for more spinning. So being out of Jacob fleece to work with, I looked through my fiber stash and I found some fiber I purchased at the Maryland Sheep and Wool Festival this past May. I made this purchase under the guidance of Sarah Hunt, who is Swensty and the host of the Fiber Trek podcast. Sarah is a proponent of conservation breeds, natural fiber. She's so knowledgeable about so many different things, and she knew that Finger Lakes Woolen Mill was going to be one of the vendors at Maryland Sheep and Wool, and she encouraged me to pick up some Hog Island fiber. Hog Island sheep are a conservation breed. They were originally farmed on Hog Island, which is a small island off the coast of Virginia. They descended from a British breed, but they grew to take on their own characteristics. It was ideal to farm sheep on an island because you didn't need to worry about fencing. And this was very successful for many years, but in the 1930s, there was a series of very intense hurricanes and coastal storms. And over the course of the following 15 years, all of the human inhabitants left Hog Island, and they left a lot of sheep there. Without a great deal of human care, the Hog Island sheep started to change their characteristics a little bit. So the qualities of their fiber are a little bit different if they're being shorn every spring than if they're not being shorn. And so these sheep grew to be feral. There was an effort to remove all of them in 1974, and then folks went back in 1979, and there was a thriving population again. So they didn't find them all. These sheep are known to be very hardy, very good mothers who usually give birth to twins. They're great at browsing rather than grazing. And that's something I would like to look into a bit more to understand the true difference between those two things. So when these sheep were finally all removed, there was an effort made to preserve the characteristics of the breed. Many of them have been relocated to Mount Vernon. And there's also a thriving population around the Finger Lakes. And so the Finger Lakes woolen mill processes their fiber and then brings it to shows like Maryland Sheep and Wool. My purchase was a 4-ounce package of Roving. I didn't realize at the time that I purchased it that it was Roving. It's not so aligned or smooth as combed top, but it is in kind of a tubular shape that makes it relatively easy to draft. I have been thinking about adjectives to use to describe the quality of the Hog Island sheep fiber, and the best adjective I can come up with is spongy. The staple length of this fiber is very short. I would not say that the fiber is coarse, but it's not soft. It has nice loft to it. It's quite springy, but it's not really so much springy as spongy. So the package contains 2 ounces each of a creamy color off-white fiber, as well as a very pale gray fiber. Because of the short staple length, I think it's a little bit difficult to spin on my Luette, which has a lot of uptake, and it can be difficult to control the intake of those fibers. So I've been using my Aegean drop spindle from Jenkins Yarn Tools, and I'm able to get a pretty consistent single on that. It's taken me a lot of practice. I don't want to put too much of a twist into this single because I don't want it to become string-like. I want it to stay lofty and springy. But in order to get it to stay together, you do need to put a certain amount of twist on it or else the drop spindle will drop. So it's taken me a bit of experimentation, but I'm now getting a single that I feel pretty good about, and I'm having a lot of fun working with this Hog Island fiber. I think that this will be some ideal yarn to use for dyeing because it's not pure white, so I think it could take dyes, including natural dyes, in maybe some interesting ways. It will be a little bit heathered. And one of the things that I will be learning in the sheep to shawl class is a series of techniques for natural dyeing. So I'm hoping I can learn with my Jacob yarn, and then maybe I can practice more at home with this Hog Island yarn. This isn't really the front porch because I've begun this project already, but I haven't talked about it in the previous episode, I don't think. I am still working on knitting the drape front sweater. It's a pattern by Roberta Rosenfeld. It appeared in a book of easy Vogue sweaters, and I am knitting this in the Bartlett Yarns Sport Cone. I think I mentioned in a previous episode that the color was blackberry, but it isn't. It's mountain laurel. It's a beautiful heathered purple. It's a 2-ply yarn. It is quite Crisp to work with initially, but I have knit up a swatch and washed the swatch, and it softens and relaxes considerably upon washing. So even though this sweater is not much to look at right now and almost has kind of an unpleasant hand to it, I am very optimistic about the finished pattern. It's knit flat in two pieces, a front and a back. I am more than halfway through the back and the front is already done. So I anticipate being able to complete this sweater by the end of February. I need to finish the knitting and then I will wash and block both pieces before I seam them together. I think that will be essential, number one, because I am not very experienced at all with seaming. And number two, the finished pieces are just, they're rolling up on themselves something fierce. It looks like it would be a sweater for a toddler because the knitted piece is just, it's just all rolled up on itself right now. But I'm not worried because when I knit my swatch, that's the way it looked too. And I just soaked it and I didn't even need to pin it. I just let it lay out on my blocking squares and the whole thing softened up and it was lying flat with no problem. So the optimism persists. I'm also looking forward to passing on a number of additional projects once I complete that sweater. But for now, I need to stay focused. Off the shelf. I've been having a great time reading along and participating in the discussion thread about housekeeping, a short novel by Marilyn Robinson. It is the focus of our first read-along at Yarns at Yin Hu. And I'm very gratified by the level of interest that listeners have expressed. There is a little list of objective chapters at the top of the thread. And for this coming week, the week starting February 22nd, we are reading chapter 7. At least one reader has completed the work, and I think there are still a few folks who intend to read and haven't begun. So wherever you are, that's exactly the place you should be. Enjoy it. Go back and reread sections if you like. A lot of folks have mentioned that they need to read more slowly than usual, because the narration in this book is quite dense. And it seems like overall folks are enjoying it. In the last episode, I talked quite a bit about the first chapter. And shifting from the first chapter to the second, there are many, many, many layers of transition that occur, which just reinforces the masterful ability of the author, Marilyn Robinson. It was Susie Polka Dot Knits who alerted me to the fact that the first chapter contains absolutely not one speck of dialogue. And chapter 2 is predominantly dialogue. And it's highly expressive of the characters of the aunts. Ruth, the narrator, doesn't really spend a lot of time describing the aunts. She conveys them quite consistently through their dialogue. And I find it amusing, informative and amusing at the same time. And then in chapter 3, Sylvie arrives. It's just so expertly done. I really like the way that Sylvie's name is used at the very end of chapter 2, and then not again until the end of the first paragraph in chapter 3. So I'll just do a little bit of reading here. This is the first paragraph of chapter 3. It was still late winter when they sent for her, and it was not yet spring when she came. They had urged her to consider before she replied, and they had assured her at length, and in the kindliest language, the letter was some days in composition, that there was no urgency in their request, and that she must take all the time she needed to set her affairs in order before she came, if she should do so. And then one day, as we sat at supper in the kitchen, and they worried between them about her not writing back, and remembered her as too dreaming and self-absorbed to be ordinarily considerate, and hoped she was not ill, Sylvie knocked at the door. It's like the characters in the work, as well as we, the readers, have been waiting for Sylvie's arrival since the first letter of the first page. So I really like the way that's done, and I enjoy all of the different ways that Sylvie is characterized. She's given a lot of attention in the description, and there have been some really fascinating posts and comments about this on our Ravelry thread. But more and more as I continue reading, and where I am in the novel right now is I think I'm just about finished with chapter 6, the more I become fascinated with Sylvie and I'm drinking in, just like Ruthie and Lucille must have been drinking in every detail about her, the more I feel a little bit anxiety-ridden about her permanence. The characters often wonder if she's disappeared, if she's left, if she's about to leave town. Often they don't know where Sylvie is in the novel. And I feel like this idea of intransience is becoming more and more powerful. The way Sylvie moves, the way Ruthie expresses things about her as filmy and uncertain and dreamlike, the more I start to feel worry and anxiety about her ability to be present for the girls. And even though, I guess it's becoming more apparent to me that even though she's there, and she seems to feed them and provide for them in very basic ways, she really doesn't have that much influence over their upbringing or their behavior. And it makes me worry and it makes me wonder at the same time. So that's where I am right now. I wanted to read something else. Let me see if I can find it. There was a passage that particularly expressed this intransience. Yes, it's in chapter 4. The girls call out to her, "Sylvie? Here." Her voice came from the porch. "I'm just getting some wood. I've never seen such a dark night." "Well, come back in." We heard the wash, wash, wash of her footsteps. "I really never have," she said. "It's like the end of the world." "Well, let's go back upstairs." But Sylvie had fallen silent again. Guessing that she must be listening to something, we were silent too. The lake still thundered and groaned. The floodwaters still brimmed and simmered. When we did not move or speak, there was no proof that we were there at all. The wind and the water brought sounds intact from any imaginable distance. Deprived of all perspective and horizon, I found myself reduced to an intuition, and my sister and my aunt to something less than that. I was afraid to put out my hand for fear it would touch nothing, or to speak for fear no one would answer. We all stood there silently for a long moment. Lucille said in a very loud voice, "I'm really tired of this." Sylvie patted at my shoulder. "It's all right, Lucille." "I'm not Lucille," I said. I like the way that's the power and the vacuous feeling of that passage closes with a little bit of humor. I feel like I need it because sometimes it seems like Marilynne Robinson is suspending us over this great chasm. And if it weren't for the humor, I think it would be a lot more imposing of a narrative. The reactions of the girls, their bickering, and quite a bit of the sensory detail kind of pull everything back to reality. And there's that very delicate balance between reality and this concept of transience that keep playing this tug of war throughout. Of course, this is just a smattering of the things that have caught my attention as I'm reading. There are so many more. The lake and water in general make frequent appearances. I think that is worth a great deal more conversation. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that on the board. And also, at this point, when I get to the center of a novel, I think it's an interesting exercise to try and figure out what is the narrative core of the text, or where does the work pivot? We talk about a narrative as having a beginning, a middle, and an end. And even when the author plays with time, as in this work, where we know that Ruthie is narrating on her childhood from a point somewhere in her adulthood, we learn all of these things, especially the tragic things that have happened to the family in the past. There's this playing with time, but still, there's a point in the novel at which you turn, or the author moves you toward an ending. And I like, as I'm reading, and especially as I'm rereading, to see if I can find that point where the narration pivots. So even though, in terms of pages, this wouldn't be necessarily the dead center of the text, it is the narrative center or core of the text. It can be a fun thing to do with poetry as well, and maybe it's a technique for examining poetry that I bring into my prose reading. But that could be an interesting exercise, if you're interested, to think about when you feel yourself no longer delving toward the center of the novel, but shuttling out of it toward an end. What is that point when you feel that? What happens, or what is the tone? What is the shift in form or narration that makes you feel like, okay, this isn't the middle anymore, now we're moving toward the end? So that could be something interesting to think about as we continue reading. I love the comments, the conversation that's going on in the Ravelry thread. folks have also been sharing ideas about other texts that are similar in some way to housekeeping. Paula of Knitting Pipeline has done a great deal of talking in the past few episodes about three other works by Marilyn Robinson. They are three interconnected works, and housekeeping is not connected with those pieces, but they could be certainly worth looking at if you're interested in more of this kind of reading. Another novel that I can recommend as similar in tone, it's quite a serious work. It's kind of a heavy one, but like housekeeping, it's also very short, and that is Ethan Frome. It's a short novel by American author Edith Wharton. Many of Edith Wharton's works concern high society in New York in the, I guess it would be like the Edwardian period. The same kind of time period at the beginning of the Downton Abbey series, but taking place in the United States. So that's sort of the period that she's known for writing about. Ethan Frome, however, is a departure from her usual writing about high society folks. It's a cold, kind of brutally cold winter setting. Very few characters, very slow-paced plot. It is not plot-driven as a novel. And there is also some interesting play with shifts in time, as well as an interesting choice of narrator. So that could be something to think about if you're interested in more of this kind of reading. Yarn Lover at Large. I'd just like to provide a little bit of an update on my plans to attend the Washington County Fiber Tour in April. I still plan to attend. But when I talked about it in last episode, I was a little nervous because I was advocating an event that I've never been to before. So this week, Saratoga Knitting, who has attended the event and whose opinion I trust, spoke very enthusiastically about it and has even listed many of the locations on the tour and what she enjoyed about visiting there in the past. So I would like to reaffirm my enthusiasm for this event. It's April 25th and 26th in Washington County, New York. This is north of Troy, east of Saratoga Springs. So in that region, there are a number of farms and fiber-related businesses. There's a woolen mill also there, some great eateries, so I think it will be a lot of fun. I plan to spend both Friday and Saturday night in the area and do some touring around on all day Saturday and probably Sunday early in the day as well. It looks like we are working toward getting a group together for dinner on Saturday evening. So if you plan to attend or if you live in the area and you'd like to be involved, please post a note on the thread on the Yarns at Yinhu Ravelry group. I've set up a separate thread for information about the tour, and that's where I've provided a link to information online, and that's where Saratoga Knitting has posted some more specific information about her experience. I look forward to more planning in the future and getting together a nice group to visit some farms. I'm just thinking about how wonderful it will be to see green grass and young lambs and have that smell of spring in the air and all of the snow. Just a faint memory.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Music for this episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Chris DeLong and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Nature's love will get you high till your face is mine. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.